Thank you all, and it's great to see you. And I very much appreciate what I've learned through the sessions and in conversations, and I hope that the next 12 to 15 minutes are useful to you as well. I'm here to represent five people who have put a large amount of sweat equity and intellectual capacity into the work that I'm going to share with you this afternoon, beginning with Jung Wong, Julie Laudick, a former postdoc with me, Julie, a former graduate student, Nicole and Sonia and Mark, all of whom have contributed quite meaningfully to the work I'm going to be sharing with you in the next few minutes. With support from SCRI, with support from the Organic Transitions Program, with support from SARE, and with support from private industry supporters, most notably Tri-Hishtil, we've been able to begin to address a specific problem. This system is by far globally the most prominent within many of our vegetable production systems. It's a raised bed covered with plastic mulch and drip tape. It's arguably the gold standard. You can travel nearly anywhere in the globe and see it, and people rely on it quite heavily. Part of the soft underbelly, if you will, some of the drawbacks of the standard system is the amount of resources that are required to put that system into place. Some energy, and by energy I mean not necessarily physical energy, but fuel and all of the other requirements required to produce the plastic and drip tape, especially the plastic, and to shape the beds. Some of those resources are non-renewable, of course, and unable to be repurposed. There's also the challenge that putting in raised beds of the sort that we rely on so heavily can lead to losses of soil structure and promoting more erosion, compaction, leaching, and runoff, because essentially what we have transformed an area as a field that would normally be able to accommodate more rainfall or more irrigation to roughly one half of that, depending on how you do the calculation, as being impermeable. So all the water runs into the furrows, and of course that water needs to go somewhere. So reduced tillage systems, as I'm sure many of you know, including strip tillage, have long been tested as a possible alternative to that, and there is a very strong literature on the topic, and that literature continues to grow. Despite that literature, there are still some significant questions that remain unanswered, which we are attempting to address. As that literature will describe for you, if you're not familiar with it, but some of you have already lived quite well, the strip tillage sequence goes as follows, and as the asterisk indicates, there are exceptions to every factor that I'm showing you in the picture. There's first you grow a cover crop or grow some sort of crop that will become the mulch, excuse me. In this case, we're using wheat. Wheat is not necessarily the ideal crop for us, but it is a crop that we grow, and I say we, in Ohio, in the areas that I'm working in, is very prominent, very common. So for folks who are considering a strip till experiment on their farm, they may have acreage of wheat and may be able to try. So we are beginning with wheat as well. We terminate that cover crop in some way. We can green chop it. We can spray it. We can take whatever steps we need to terminate it. In this case, we cut it and baled it, and it went over to the dairy. We install tilled strips. Now again, what you see here is a one-time rototiller going across the field. We do not have a strip tiller. There are, of course, quality strip till implements available, and of course they work better than a one-time rototiller. But again, with one doesn't have a strip tiller, one can't, and one does have a one-time rototiller. That's what we can experiment with, and it's working out fairly well. Regardless, you're creating a zone of a narrow zone. Where the soil has been worked. And then one will transplant or direct seed into that particular area. In our case, we're working with grafted and ungrafted tomato, which we'll get to here in just a moment. All of that process, the steps 1, 2, 3, and 4, stands in somewhat stark contrast to what you see here, which in some cases, after the ground has been prepared in a preliminary fashion, plowing and cultivating, one can make it in one pass. One can shape the beds, lay the plastic and drip tape, and maybe even transplant at the same time. But either way, those steps 1 through 4, the strip till process, reduced till process, stands in stark contrast to what you're seeing here. We have much less soil disturbance in that system. We till only the areas we will plant. The rest of the area is left undisturbed. And that living or recently killed mulch is acting, residue is acting as a mulch. So if you put all that together, you can write down the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the page the pros and cons of strip tillage, all of which are fairly well documented and discussed and hypothesized about. The one disadvantage of the strip till or often reduced till approach is that they are often lower yielding, and that is a hindrance to adoption. So the question and the approach that we're question that we have and the approach that we're using is as follows. In 2018, last year, we asked, do grafted plants and or the use of grafted plants and or a microbe-containing biostimulant increase the production of a strip-till tomato system? And we're looking here for either individual or additive effects. One could be at work alone, they could work independently, or they could work in a stacked function, if you will, and end up with an additive effect. We were encouraged, if you will, to ask this question and take this approach by preliminary experiments that we have been involved with for a number of years, actually dating back to actually before 2015. But in 2015, we had a standard system, strip-till system, and actually a no-till system as well. And we had living and dead plant residue mulch. And we had some encouraging results from that. We've also been very active in the area of grafting, and if you're following that area of work as well, you appreciate that rootstock varieties differ in their root system properties. So we have seen this in our work as well. There are large rooted varieties and smaller rooted varieties, and varieties that of course have a different package of traits. We've also reported on the fact that rootstock varieties differ in their vigors beginning at the seedling stage. So we were comfortable with the idea that across the roots, within the rootstock group of varieties, we would have the necessary variation to include in a study that I'll describe for you in just a moment. And of course, we shouldn't ignore the work that has been done in North Carolina State University most recently. David Suchoff, Chris Gunter, and others clearly demonstrating additional root system traits that may be compatible with a strip-till system, such as different root architecture, response to water deficits, and the like. We also had conducted a couple of greenhouse experiments exploring the interaction between grafting and microbial-based biostimulants, and just at the seedling stage, not taken to full production. And this work was reported a couple of, last year, 2 years ago in Hawaii, demonstrating that, yes, we actually witnessed additive effects between grafting and microbial biostimulants at the seedling development stage. But in 2018 and now in 2019, we essentially have an experiment with 12 treatments. There are 4 grafting treatments, including the ungrafted scion, and 3 inoculation treatments. And I'd like to just point out really quickly, rootstock A, listed there as submarine. You might know of it as supernatural. Supernatural was the name that it was released with, but that was a trade name for a specific grafted plant product, not the actual name of the rootstock itself. The actual name of the rootstock itself is submarine. So if you happen to see supernatural, it is actually submarine. Anyway, we had a 4x3 factorial. We created the strips. We dropped those grafted or ungrafted plants into the strips in a randomized replicated fashion, randomized complete block design. And I don't have much of a pointer here, but I'll try to indicate just in the upper quadrant of the map there, you see 12 colored blocks. Each color represents a different rootstock or grafting treatment, and there are two blocks of each color that would be inoculated or not. So we have 6 replicates of the strip-till system, and in the center we included 2 replicates of the standard system, and then the other. We're not here necessarily to compare directly, and in the most robust fashion, strip-till versus. Standard raised beds. Our primary interest is in the performance of the strip-till system, but we do want to have a plastic-covered raised bed comparison available to us. Randomized complete block design, 6 reps of strip-till, 2 of standard raised beds. All the plots contained 8 plants. 6 were treated, 2 were used as guard, and data were collected on the center 4 plants. The 3 inoculation treatments, were represented by None, of course, and then one product from Lalamond, one product from a greenhouse. I'm not here to stump for any one particular company or product. I am happy to say, however, that a greenhouse and Lalamond have been excellent companies to work with. And as you can see by the brief description of their products, these two products differ in their makeup with regard to the species that are present. So standard experimental timeline for our area, plant in mid to late May, inoculate four times, harvest as many times as Mother Nature will allow us, and collect both the yield and quality data. And yes, we actually did inoculate by hand that entire 96 plot field. It's very tedious, but it's very reliable. We always followed inoculation immediately with irrigation, and we do not always hand inoculate. We do inject through the irrigation lines as many products are eligible for in other experiments. This is the way the experiment looked approximately 1 year ago. And you can see that they're doing quite well, but the two in the foreground and the top, those are plastic covered raised beds. Notice how much larger they are. We collected all the fruit at the blush stage and later, and collected a full battery of data. I'm sure is very, very familiar with that. And in 2018, we subsampled for measures of titratable acidity, Brix, pH, Brix, and titratable acidity. So preliminary results, and there are only two data slides. So looking at the data this way, and I look forward to presenting the full battery of data once they are collected here in 2019 and perhaps in 2020, where we can perform much more rigorous statistical analysis. I'm just showing the means plus minus the standard errors here and the total cumulative yield. This is the yield accumulated throughout the entire year. This is not the yield at any one particular harvest. You can still see quite obviously that the standard system is outperforming the strip-till system in terms of total yield. You can see also evidence for the increased yield resulting from the use of grafted plants. You can also see some evidence for possibly an upward tick in the yield as a function of inoculation. If we take these data and we further condense them into the three panels that I'm showing here, the first one is all the data for plus minus inoculation are pooled. The question is grafted, yes or no. We see in the standard system a significant effect of grafting and a significant effect of grafting in the strip-till system. Now, in the second panel, the grafted plant data were pooled, plus and minus grafting. Now the question is, were they inoculated? You see a marginal increase as a function of inoculation, primarily in the standard system only. In the strip-till system, inoculation appeared to have virtually no impact on yield. And then you look at the third panel, which is ungrafted, were they inoculated? And in a standard system, the inoculation effect jumps out. And of course, these are both products. This is not specific to one product or another. And the inoculation effect was essentially nil in the strip-till system. So in summary, having gotten the five-minute sign, I want to leave time for questions if there are any. I was asked before the presentation if there's anything to biostimulants. Having worked with them in this experiment and many others, I would say, yes, there is something to them, but it is an inconsistent response, and one needs great care, if you will, in evaluating that response. And secondly, is there something to grafting? I think very clearly there is something to grafting, but again, as we've had conversations outside of this room and in other programs, the message is also clear there. It also has to be done very, very carefully, meaning not necessarily the grafting process, but the selection of rootstock and scion, and then the application of grafted plants in any one production system. So if there is any time, I'll be glad to address a question or two. Yes. Good question. It was, how did we decide how wide of a strip to leave in that strip-till system? It was primarily dictated by the equipment we have available. And I know at UK they have all of the equipment one would want for this. In our case, taking out two tines from that rototiller would have been too wide, in our opinion. One tine was enough. I do think it needs to be wider, though. I do think that this particular strip, which is roughly 6 inches in the neighborhood of 15 centimeters, yeah, 6 inches wide is a little bit on the narrow side. Yeah. Mark. The drip is laid right on top of the strip. Exactly. Yes. Thanks.
Do you have any idea about the non-consistent response of the use of inoculants? Particularly, you see a response in use rate there, you don't see a response in OTIO. That's quite interesting.
It's very interesting, and I wish I could explain it further, but I do have, I feel like, that's an active area of research in our lab just biostimulants alone, and we've been able to convene a number of experts around the topic and listen carefully to what they have to say. And the overall message is that in some cases we don't know what the explanation for what you just asked, but it always comes back to, is the inoculant likely to form a productive relationship with the crop? There is host specificity. Secondly, is the inoculant proven to be active? There are, unfortunately, products on the market that when you break open the bag or open the seal, the inoculant is actually not active. Third, was the inoculant killed before application? Fourth, is it killed certainly soon after application? Is it applied in the correct amount at the correct time? So there are at least quite a large number of gates that the inoculant needs to pass through in order to have a high chance of success. And I don't know if we're lucky or good or what have you, but we're just trying to find that particular constellation of factors that provide the most consistent response. So I appreciate that question. Yes? I want to say the first inoculations were roughly 2 to 3 weeks after planting. So we have May 24th, and then the first inoculation was June 11th, yeah, at least in 2018, and then continue for roughly a month thereafter, 2 months
ago. Why didn't you inoculate the transplants themselves?
Very good question. It's often asked, and I appreciate that. We do inoculate now the transplants. Jim was asking, why didn't we inoculate in the greenhouse before taking to the field? That is certainly a very viable option. People do use it. We were also, in this particular work, we were interested in the after the fact application directly to the soil. But I do think that's a more reliable way to go.
Maybe this is, you maybe addressed this, but how did you address weed management and then that potential interaction with all the rest?
Weed management. As you can tell, our weed management eventually became the lawnmower. And I'm not ashamed, I'm not smirking or anything when I say that, because it became a challenge with the raised, with the strip-till system. But, that was the first part of your question. I apologize. What was the second part?
And the interactions with your treatments.
The interactions with treatments. I don't know if our data we are able with our data to ferret that out. I really don't. Offhand, if I'm allowed to just speculate here, I would say that there is justification for considering a system where it's not a bare ground between the rows. That in a better strip-till system, such I've seen with Ajay's and Zach's and others, the between-row space is actually living or dead. And I'm intrigued by, at least especially on highly erodible land, which we have some of, I'm very intrigued by the possibility of a living mulch that's put in place that is a minimum competitor with the crop but performs other functions. I mean, the so-called holy grail of living mulches, if you will. Shin, yeah.
Do you have exact same facility management program for both?
Exact same what?
Fertility management program.
The fertility program is similar but not identical, if only because, you know, we apply slightly less fertilizer to the raised beds than would normally be done. We're trying to keep it in line with the strip-till system. So our Midwest production guide recommends, for example, about 120 to 150 pounds of N. We're on the lower side of that, 120 pounds. So it's very similar between the experiments. I think I misunderstood your question. But it's not necessarily consistent with the broadest recommendations. Yes?
Will the biostimulants for a better with plants growing in the field condition than growing
Will the biostimulants work better in, with plants inoculated in the field, growing in the field, or with plants in a container and a possibly soil or substrate? I'm aware that a large amount of literature on biostimulants is developed with greenhouse experiments, sometimes soilless medium, sometimes not. I think it's, a medium truly does matter. As I recall, one of the first presentations I gave on a topic, somebody asked, will that work on my soil type? And I said, I wish I could tell you. No one truly knows. It only can be found through experimentation. I think the medium matters, but I think control over other variables matter just as much, if not more, particularly soil moisture, the crop and the microbe selection, the fertility program, like Shin just mentioned, and temperature. All four of those matter a lot.
Question?